family that I've been privileged to know and when they came into the program. And I've seen them grow, and I've seen some three beautiful people that have just grown into some very, very special friends of mine. I believe that the first speaker tonight is going to be our little Alateen, Polly C.
Hi, I'm Polly, and I'm a really grateful member of Alateen.
Hi.
You know, I never really figured out how in the world they got people to stand up here and talk, and now I know. They asked me in October. Well, in October, I said, well, sure thing, no problem. Not realizing what I was getting myself into, and about 2 weeks ago, it hit me that I was going to be standing up here in front of all you people, and I said, now I know it. So they trick you. But I'm glad that they tricked me into this one, because there's no place that I would rather be. You know, when they talk about alcoholism, you hear an awful lot about the alcoholic, and you hear an awful lot about the spouse. And more we're really, the kids are becoming involved. And, you know, for so long, people really denied the fact that children were also affected by the disease of alcoholism. And when you live in a really sick situation, I don't care if you're 10 years old, 14 years old, or 40 years old, you're going to be affected. And I know this in my own life without any doubt. As the alcoholism progressed, and they say how it's a progressive disease, boy, you better believe I progressed right along with it. And I can remember when I was little, you know, I knew that things weren't exactly right. I mean, I figured most parents came home before 3 in the morning, but I wasn't really sure. And so I really didn't know, so I couldn't say, well, I'm living in a sick situation. But as things got worse in our home, I can look back now and see how my life got worse and worse and worse. It's like at one time, I used to be, I was a really, you know, when I was younger, I was a really good kid. And to get attention and to get what I, you know, the affection that I needed, I would just, you know, I would be really good and everybody liked me and I was every teacher's pet and, you know, I got the best grades and I did everything that, you know, just, it was great. Everybody liked me. And that got me some attention at home because if I did a lot of good things and got recognized, well then, you know, Mom and Dad had no choice but to look at me. And so I can remember that things really didn't go too bad for me for a while, at least not at school. I could handle things at school. I could leave most of my problems at home, or at least I thought I was leaving it at home. And I could function in school well, and I could get along with people. But then when I went home, you know, here I was a schizophrenic here. I was two different people. I'd go to school, and I'd be the nicest person you ever met. And I'd come home, and oh, my God, I was the snottiest person, you know, and I couldn't stand Mom. You know, Dad was never home, so you couldn't hate him. And so, you know, Mom was the one to be there, you know, and she was the one that, she was trying to run the family. She was trying to run her life, and then, you know, I don't know where Dad was, but so I really learned not to like her because she stood for everything I was against, and everything she did was wrong. And I really figured, I said, well, you know, I didn't really know why my dad didn't come home, but every time he did, Mom would always start yelling and screaming at him. Well, I said, no wonder the guy doesn't want to come home. I wouldn't want to come home and hear that either. And so I couldn't blame him. I said, well, I got a crazy mom, and my dad's just normal, and he doesn't want to be around her. So I went along this way, and I was really able to go through school up until about the fifth grade. I think I made it through the fifth grade, and I was still fairly, you know, I was really having a hard time at home, and I really didn't ever get along with home. I was always, I based my happiness on what my dad was doing. And if he was home, I was happy. Well, about 90% of the time, I was unhappy because that's about how often he was home. It was about 10%. So that really meant a lot of unhappiness for me. And I can remember in school, you know, really feeling hurt and really feeling alone. And I was really a loner in the sense that I could really get along with people. But once we were out of school, that was it. Because I was always afraid if they invited me to their house, I'd have to invite them to mine. And my God, I didn't want to invite him to my house because you know what? I never knew what was going to happen, ever. I mean, I wasn't sure, you know, and so I really was afraid to be too close to people because of that. And I always held my head up high, and I said, you know, everything's great at my house, and you know, I really wanted people to believe that I lived in the home. And I wanted people to really think that I had it made, and so I would brag, and, you know, that was the only way I felt I could get any attention. I certainly didn't want to bring them home and show them how great I lived, but I would tell them that. And so pretty soon, you know, you can go along this way for a while, and you can fool people. And I think, I don't know, I thought I had them pretty well fooled. I really don't know. But you can't do that forever. And as the alcoholism progressed, and as things got worse in my house, I progressed right along with it. And then I can remember, things didn't go so well at school anymore. I had a lot of fear and a lot of anger, and that really started to come out at school. I got into the habit of telling people exactly what I thought of them. And when you live in an alcoholic home, you don't think a whole lot of good things. So I can remember really, you know, telling teachers off, and then I got that attitude of who cares. And that was a really, you know, that to me is the saddest thing. When I hear somebody say, who cares, you know, that really is just a really sad thing to hear, because that's just giving up. And so I really started to get worse like this. And then in about the sixth grade, I was in sixth grade, and having, you know, really having my, probably one of my worst years, you know, things were really getting rotten, and we were going to Florida. Well, I said, this will make up for it. We're going to Florida. And we're taking a vacation. You know, we weren't the vacationing family. And matter of fact, we didn't go anywhere. It's the first time I've been to Bloomington, by the way, so I was kind of excited about that, too. And so we were going to Florida, and I was happy, and boy, I was happy as a lark, and I didn't care about anything else. I said, this makes up for everything. And, you know, my mom and dad were thinking the same thing. Well, about 4 days before we were going to go to Florida, Dad decided to go to treatment. And by this time, I had known about his alcoholism for about 2 years. And I really didn't know anything about the program. You know, it was about fourth grade, and Mom said, well, Dad's an alcoholic. And I said, oh, you know, right. You know, I believe you. And I didn't really know what it was at the time. And so then she suggested Alateen meetings when I was about fourth grade. I said, oh, sure, I'll go. You know, I was willing to do anything. And that didn't last long, because when I found out what it was, I said, well, you know, I don't want to go anymore. And so I was really excited about going on this trip. And my dad went to treatment about 4 days before, which meant that we couldn't go. And this was over Christmas time. And I knew that even though I didn't know much about alcoholism, I knew that treatment was probably the right thing. But I couldn't believe it. I couldn't believe it. Here I am. All I ever wanted was to go to Florida. And now I can't even go to Florida. You know, what is God? Why is God punishing me? What did I do? You know, I mean, nothing goes my way. I said, this is it. I've had it now. And that was a turning point in my life, when I went from bad to worse, and I can remember that was just crushing. And Dad called on the phone, and I said, boy, that takes guts to call from a treatment center. You know, that takes a lot of guts to tell your kid you're not going to Florida anymore. You know, we didn't go anywhere anyway. So I felt sorry in heck for myself. And I remember, you know, really feeling bad, and like, you know, I couldn't really be mad, because it was such a hard time in our house. And so I can just remember, though, just being so depressed and so upset that really, you know, I never really got over that for a long time. I carried that with me for so long, that really sad depression. So my dad got back from treatment, and I said, okay, well, I figured, well, we can't go to Florida, right? Well, he's back from treatment. Things will be great. And the one thing I really, you know, really shows that alcoholism, you have to get better. It doesn't matter what the alcoholic is doing. I really found that out, because I thought, here my mom had been in the program a couple years, and here Dad was sober now. So, okay, things would be all right for me. Things got worse than they had ever been when my mom started to get better and my dad started to get sober. Things really, really got bad. I mean, I didn't care one way or the other about anything. And then Mom and Dad were trying to make up for other things, and they're trying to, you know, they're knowing where I'm at, and they're trying to do something, and they can't do anything. And I really just hit, just, you know, I made it through that sixth grade year, and barely. And I'm telling you, I had the smartest mouth of any person you have ever seen. And, you know, like Father Martin says, he says, kids of alcoholics are always compulsive talkers because they're told to shut up so much. So now you know why I'm like this. But, so I can remember that I entered seventh grade year, and this is my junior high year. And, you know, the one thing about living in an alcoholic home that is so tough, and what really makes it extra tough on the kids, is that it's so hard to grow up anyway. And it's so difficult with all the peer pressure and entering junior high and really, really tough years. And then with the craziness at home and the disease of alcoholism, you really can't bear it unless you get help for yourself. So then 7th grade, that was a mess. I mean, 7th grade, God, that was the year. I thought 6th grade was bad. 6th grade was nothing. I had a great year compared to 7th grade. And I can remember times I just couldn't even cope with life anymore. I got to the point where, I couldn't bring anybody home still. I was just really, I made up my mind that I was never going to bring anybody to my house, and so I didn't do it. No matter, even if I knew I could trust my dad, which I do, I couldn't ever trust him because I really never knew what he was going to do. And even though he was sober, and even though my mom was getting better, I still, you live in the past for a long time. And so I just got to the point where I go in my room, and I shut the door, and I put on my headphones, and I would just live in my own little world by myself, and I didn't want to let anybody else in, and I didn't want to talk about it, and I just wanted to be depressed. And so about this time, I decided to get a boyfriend that would do it too, and that didn't do anything, and I got, and then I started, I tried drugs a little bit, see how that works, and I never got involved heavily in them, but I can remember, really experimenting and wanting to know, looking for something else, because I couldn't cope just with me, and I couldn't just cope at home. And so I got to the point where I would do anything for attention and anything to have friends. So what I would do is I would always be, I'd go to everybody's side. And, I would go with one friend and say, well, I'll be on your side. And I went from side to side with all my friends. And pretty soon, here I was being real nice, and they were all on one side, and I was all by myself. And I didn't know what happened. I just God, I don't have any friends. I couldn't stand my mom. I couldn't stand my dad. By this time he was home now, so now I didn't like him either. And so I really was at the really lowest point in my life. And one night we were sitting at the kitchen table, and mom and dad said, well, they happened to bring this up. They said, well, it's about time you started to go to Alateen. And I got a real big kick out of that. I was Alateen. That was kind of funny at the time. And I said, you're nuts. I said, I'm not going to Alateen. And I didn't want to say much to Dad, and I went up to Mom after dinner. And I said very sincerely, Mom, I know that you think I have been affected by the disease of alcoholism. And I understand that, because you have been. But I really think that I was too young. Well, yeah. And how in the heck she kept a straight face was, that was such a sick statement, though, that, it really wasn't funny, but I look back and how in the world could I be in that position and say there was nothing wrong with me? Well, anyway, it didn't matter whether or not I wanted to go to Alateen. I was going to Alateen no matter, because they were going to tie me up and drag me to the meetings and strap me to the chair if that's what it took. So I said, all right, okay, I'm going. So I got in my first meeting and I got myself two chairs, one to put my feet on, the other one to lean back in. And I decided I'd really get comfortable. And people would say, so you're coming to Alateen again, because I had been there a few years before. And they said, and I said, yeah, well, it gets my parents off my back for a week. This is really it. I said, if I went to Alateen for a week, my parents wouldn't say one thing to me. So I'd sit back in the meetings, and I can remember, just kind of messing around and laughing, and I wouldn't say anything. And I didn't listen, and I just waited, I watched the clock until it was 8 o'clock or 9 o'clock, and then I'd run out, first one to leave. And I went like that for a while. And pretty soon, things got so bad that I really didn't have a choice but to listen. So I started to go into the meetings, and I started to listen to what they were saying. And, that was the first step for me. I still hadn't admitted there was anything wrong with me, of course, but I admitted, that I was going to listen at least. And I listened to what they had to say, and I said some things myself. And I can really remember, one night it hit me, my God, I am sick. This disease has affected me, and I can remember that. I remember that day. I really knew that alcoholism was a disease. And, a lot of times people would say, "Oh, well, alcoholism is a disease, don't you?" "Oh, sure, sure." People would say something. I say, "Oh, yeah, right. I know that." And I didn't know that. I didn't know that for a long time. And I can remember, just saying, I just remember that night so well, and I really knew that I had to do something about my life. Well, the first thing for me to do was just to go into the meetings and to contribute a little bit and to listen. And I started to do that, and then I made up my mind of which way in life I wanted to take. I still wasn't, working the program real well or anything, but I knew that I didn't want to live the way I was living, and I knew that I wanted to be happy. And so I really started to contribute and to start to listen. and to start to want to go to the meetings. And then pretty soon, I would try something the meetings had to do. It's like when my brothers and I would be in a big argument, I would say, okay, I'm going to ignore this, and it would work. You know, this program really worked, and I was shocked. And so I realized that it worked, and I would try these little things. You know, it's like I was testing the meeting, and I was testing the program. You know, I wanted to see if what they were telling me was true. And it worked. And so, you know, slowly I really started to grab some concepts of what was going on. And I started to work it in my own life. And I started to realize for the first time that I could be happy and that I could change. You know, my sayings were, life is a bummer, and I am how I am how I am, and I will never change. And I realized that there were a lot of good things out there, things that I had never, ever seen, things that I had never thought about could ever be good. And I started to enjoy life for the first time. It's like I could smile, and the thing that I think the program did more for me than anything was the fact that I could be myself. At a time when things were so bad, along, you know, with just the peer pressure, the problems at home, I could be who I was, and I could be an individual. This program has taught me a new way to live. Life isn't a bummer. Life is wonderful. And with this program, what's really neat about this program for me is that life is wonderful now. I can still grow in this program, and I can keep going to meetings and keep learning more and more and more, and I can continue to be happier than I am today, which is hard to imagine being happier than I am right now. And, you know, I really learned a lot of things in the program, and I learned that the things that my parents were doing didn't reflect on me, and it had nothing to do with me, and it had to do with their own sickness. And I could love them no matter what they were doing, and really, I could be happy no matter whether my dad was drinking, whether my mom was going crazy, or no matter what. I could be happy, and I can be happy no matter what anybody else is doing around me if I want to feel good with inside myself. And all my feelings are based within me. And that to me is the biggest thing, because I'm in control now of my emotions. You know, I don't always do the right thing. I don't always say the right thing. I get mad. I have a bad temper sometimes. But I am in control of my emotions. I always thought that if somebody hit me, you know, I had to hit them back. And I always thought that if somebody was mad at me, I had to be mad at them. And that's not true. I am in control of my emotions, and I can choose to feel any way that I want to feel. And that really means a lot to me, because I always thought I had to have my fixed emotions and I had to do what a certain situation called for. And, you know, just to be able to now, you know, I see right now, like, this has really been a tough year for me in the sense of growing up at school. And some kids are making decisions in schools that are their own, things that I don't care to do. But even though there are a lot of times when I really feel hopeless, like, you know, what is everybody else doing? I know where I want to go in life. And I know who I am for the first time. You know, people would say, well, who are you? I would say, well, I don't know. And I know what I want to get out of life. And I don't care what other people do. And I don't care what other people have to say about me. And I know that I want to be me. Nobody else but me. And other people aren't going to change that. You know, I come across a lot of people in the program, or not even in the program, just a lot of my friends that really are having a hard time right now. And I can remember being in the exact same situation that they're in. And, you know, I feel really free about talking to them about the program. And I tell, you know, I think all my friends know my dad's an alcoholic. And I really talk about the program to them about what I, you know, just what I have learned. Not so much the program, but just what I have learned and how I feel inside. And at one time, you know, the most embarrassing thing in the world to me would have been if somebody would have found out about my dad's alcoholism. You know, and now it's like, anybody who wants to know can know. And I want, you know, I want them to know if it's going to help them out any. Because it's not a bad thing at all. And it's been a really good thing. You know, I don't ever think that, I think that when you have it easy all your life, it's really hard to appreciate the little things and the really good things in life. And this alcoholism for me, you know, as much as I hated to see my dad go through it and my mom go through it and me go through it and everything else, it has been a wonderful thing in my life. And there was no place in the world I'd rather be than right here. really enjoying life, because I wouldn't be here today if it hadn't been for my dad's alcoholism. And I wouldn't know all these good things. And, you know, I am now in contact with a higher power, which, it's like, you know, here I went to the church all my life, and, you know, God was taught to me all my life. And not until I entered the program did I find out who he was to me. And did I ever find that higher power? You know, people could have told me that they had to go to church every Sunday, you know, and Mom would drag me by the arm, and I'd have to get all dressed up, and it didn't ever mean anything to me until I got into this program. And I knew, and I know now, that he is always with me. And thank God he's with me here tonight, because I couldn't do it without him. You know, I just want to say that this program is the most wonderful thing in the world to me. And I thank God every day that he has blessed me with this opportunity. And I hope that all of you will find out the same thing, or I hope you all have, because it is the most wonderful feeling in the world. Thank you.
Now I'd like to introduce Polly's mother, Lenny. Hi, everybody. I'm Lenny.
Hi.
I, too, am a really grateful member of this program, the Al-Anon program. I don't know how I can really follow that. I feel a little overwhelmed right now. I guess I just have one prayer at this moment, that God will help me just to say what I need to say for myself, and maybe something to reach one other person and to help me get out of the way. I have a lot of ego about doing this. I always want to say the very best things in the very best way they've ever been said, and I could probably write a book if I had put down on paper all the thoughts that went through my head this week in thinking about doing this. I mentioned to a friend in the AA program last week that I must have been crazy when I said I would do this, and he said, "Could you have said no?" And I thought about that a little bit. You know, I guess I could say, no, I'm afraid. But those excuses don't hold too much water anymore. So anyway, here I am. And I guess I really feel that it's somewhat of a miracle that we're here in Bloomington. I've heard it said in the program a lot of times that everything comes full circle. And this is really where it started for Tim and I. Before Polly ever came into the picture, we were both students here at Indiana University. We went together, and we planned our marriage. I lived in a dorm called Tower Center, which is now Teeter Quad. If you think that isn't amazing, you know. But so many things are amazing in this program. If somebody had told me when I came to the first Al-Anon convention 4 years ago that, you know, I'd be standing up here tonight, I used to sit out there and shake for the person that was up here talking. So, everything works out in God's time. I always have to go back a little bit, you know, whenever I do this, because I was a really sick person long before I ever married Tim, and I didn't know that. I blamed everything that happened to me in my life on his alcoholism. But I came from a family where there were two other children, a boy and a girl, who were quite a bit older than I was, and I was the baby of my family. And so I guess I became a very dependent person, you know, at a really early age. I kind of clung to my mother, and my dad was gone a lot, and my mother and father argued all the time when he was home, and I could probably, you know, repeat a lot of things that Polly said. I guess the problem in my family as a young girl looked like compulsive gambling, and my dad was a gambler. But I guess I feel that as I go on in the program and learn more about the disease of alcoholism, that he was probably alcoholic too. It just didn't look like it. His gambling seemed to take precedence in our family because it was always an argument about money. You know, where was he? Why wasn't there enough money? There was never enough. And it was a constant struggle between my mother and father. And I guess I started to pray as a really young girl for things to change in my life, and I prayed for them to change. You know, why did God put me in this situation? And I asked myself that question a lot. Why did he do this to me? You know, why couldn't I just be like everybody else and have a nice mother and father who got along and live in a normal home? I wanted to be normal. So, you know, I went to school a lot of days when they were fighting and they were talking about leaving each other, and I would go to school and I would sit there and I'd think about that and I'd start to cry and I'd ask to go home because I was afraid when I got home maybe somebody wouldn't be there. My mother always used to say, I'll go so far you'll never see the threads of me. And I guess I, you know, kind of thought in my heart that she might someday. So I learned to feel sorry for myself at a very early age, and really self-pity became a way of life for me, and I didn't know, you know, that I was choosing that for myself. I spent a lot of lonely times in my room crying because they were fighting and I didn't want them to fight, and I thought it was my fault. If I'd be a little bit nicer, you know, do something different, maybe they wouldn't fight anymore. So I guess I felt that I would prove myself by going out into the world and putting a big smile on my face and showing everybody what a nice person I was. And I learned to do that at a very early age. And I became, you know, one person on the outside and one person on the inside. And as I grew up and saw the insanity of my family life, I kept saying to myself, I'll never live like this. When I get old enough to get out of here, I'm going to find myself a nice, happy person to spend the rest of my life with. Somebody who enjoys the same things I do, somebody who likes to do what I like to do, somebody who makes me happy. And I thought about that a lot. You know, I was going to find somebody to make me happy. A Prince Charming who was going to ride in on his white horse. And I joke about that a lot. You know, he did ride in on his white horse, and I jumped on behind him. And somewhere along the way, I fell off, and he kept going. And my married life was kind of a struggle to catch that horse, and I never could seem to catch it. So anyway, I finished high school, and I met Tim, and we went together, and we were married after a couple of years of college, and he went on to finish college. We were married right before his senior year, and I quit school and went to work. So we lived down here in Bloomington, and we had an apartment above a hardware store. And I have in my mind that we were married about 3 months. And I came home from work one night. I worked at the Bloomington National Bank. And I came home from work one night, and I fixed supper, as I always had. You know, we had a pretty good time up to that point. We walked hand in hand to the movies, and we went to the grocery store together, and we counted pennies and got peanut butter, and, you know, it was good. It was my dream come true. And I came home that evening, and I fixed dinner, and I waited for him to come. And it got kind of late, and he didn't come. And I started to look out the window, and I thought, well, I could call a friend, but that would be kind of embarrassing, and what would I say? And it got a little later, and I tried to watch television, and I kept going to the window. And pretty soon I got scared. You know, I thought, gee, I can't imagine where he is. What if something happened to him? And I tried to go to bed, and I couldn't. I got up, and I looked out the window. And I walked the floor, and I looked out the window. And pretty soon it started to storm, and I was really frightened. And I had never been alone in my house as a young girl growing up. I grew up in a family where, you know, if my mother went somewhere, I went with her. And here I was alone, and it was like 2 o'clock in the morning, and I was almost hysterical. And I got under the bed because I was so afraid of that storm. And pretty soon I heard, you know, a little knock and we lived upstairs in this apartment, and I could hear a scratching on the door. And I went to the door, and he was there, you know, and he wasn't in very good shape, and I helped him get up the steps, and I said, you know, what happened? Well, he gave me the story, and of course I believed it. And the next morning he woke up, and he really was feeling bad. He was really sick. And I felt so sorry for him, and I fixed some chicken soup, and I fed it to him in bed. I held his head. Now, you know, I'm not going to tell you too many more stories like that, because I did that for 15 years. That's the insanity of this disease, you know. I kept doing that over and over and over again. Now, I did stop fixing chicken soup somewhere along the way. But the worst part was I got so full of self-pity that I lived in it continuously. It became a way of life for me. I needed everybody's, oh, poor Lenny, how does she live that way? You know, she's raising those kids alone, she's doing this, she's doing that. I became so full of resentment, and he was the object of all of those feelings. I guess I feel, as I go on in the program, in my recovery, that my sickness is really the same as his, without the addiction. You know, we have had the same feelings, and this to me is what the program is about. It's about working through my feelings, you know, trying to be honest about who I am, and I see that I chose one road and he chose another, and really mine was the more devious, and it was the sickest. Because mine was an inward working thing. You know, you could see what he was doing, and people blamed him. Everybody blamed him. My family blamed him, my friends blamed him. They couldn't see what I was doing. They couldn't see that I was full of self-pity and resentment and hatred. You know, so much hatred that it overwhelmed me sometimes. There was a night that he came home, and it was very late, and I was praying, and I was waiting for him, and I used to sit in a chair curled up and look out the window and watch for his headlights, and I'd be saying the rosary curled up in his chair, and I'd say, please, God, you know, just let him come home, and I'd be crying, and I'd see his lights, and I'd be so happy. And this one particular night, I had all those feelings, and as he came up the walk and I could see him, I thought, that creep, and I went into the kitchen and got a butcher knife. And when he came in the house, you know, I said, if you don't stop this, I'm going to kill you. I can't live like this anymore. So, you know, it's really about feelings. Those are the things that destroy us. Those feelings that control our lives, that we can't rise above. We wallow in them, you know, and the more we feel them, the more we're stuck there, and we can't move out of it. And I kept trying to move out of it. You know, I read all the right things. I went to church and I prayed. You know, I used to get down on the floor in the hallway in our home. And I'd lay there with my arms outstretched, you know, like the monks do. And I guess I figured if it worked for the monks, maybe it would work for me. It didn't, because I was always praying for God to change him. You know, please, God, I know you don't want him to live like this. Please. Make him see the error of his ways, never thinking for a minute that maybe I could do something about myself. So, you know, somewhere along the way, God gave us three beautiful children, and I took a lot of that frustration away from Tim and put it on the children. And I guess I probably had more guilt about that in my recovery than anything I ever did in my life. They talk a lot about child abuse today, and I was a child abuser, and I really didn't know that. You know, I thought I was a disciplining mother. I thought I had to do that for their own good. And, you know, I know today that that wasn't true. It took me a long time in the program to be able to even face some of those things, to be able to say them out loud to another person, because I couldn't believe that I had done them. You know, I belittled them, I put them down. It was a lot of mental abuse, but it was also physical abuse. I can remember the first time I told someone out loud an incident that I had with Polly, and I cried because I couldn't say it, you know, and I didn't think I'd ever be able to say that without crying, but I think she was about 7 years old, and I don't know what she did anymore. I can't really remember, and it wasn't important. I know that now, but I became really angry with her. And I was always kind of bragging a little bit about my temper when I would try to tell somebody, you know, kind of a little bit what I did, but I wouldn't really give them the details. I'd say, you know, I got so mad at those kids. But I always figured that, you know, that kind of a temper was something that just went along with my Italian background. So I excused myself. But she made me angry, I said. You know, you make me so angry. And I would always chase her into her room. And this one particular afternoon, I chased her into her room with a spoon, and I hit her so hard that I broke the spoon over her bottom. And as the spoon broke, it broke my fingernail, and it broke it way back to the middle, and boy, did it ever hurt. And I said, you know, look what you did to me. And, you know, here's this little thing, and I'm hanging over her. And I was just, I'm certain I was, you know, red in the face because I felt hysterical. And when that would come on me, I could not control it. And I used to pray about that a lot. You know, I would have those attacks and those outbursts, and I would go into my room and close the door, and I'd say, please, God, don't let me do that anymore. And I'd turn right around and do it again. I had no control over it. So this particular day, it was like one thing led to another, you know, and she was laying there on the bed, and I was standing there with my bleeding fingernail, and I just said, you know, I don't want you anymore, I hate you. I pulled her clothes out of the closet, hangers and all, and I stuffed them in a paper sack, and I called Tim at work, and I said, come and get her, because I don't want her anymore. And I opened the back door and put her out on the porch. And he came home, of course. He always came home immediately. He had a lot of guilt, too. You know, I didn't know that then, but I thought I had some power over him. That's just one incident, you know. And I guess that just, to me, is the epitome of the insanity that I was suffering from at that time. And so the years went on like that. I came to a crisis in my life when my father got sick and was dying, and I had to go away on the spur of the moment a lot because he was in the hospital and he had cancer, and they would call the family in, and I would try to round something up, you know, for the kids, and I'd try to find Tim, and I couldn't find him, and so I'd have to go off and leave these kids by themselves, and I had a lot of guilt about doing that, and I had a lot of anger about the fact that I couldn't find him, and I blamed him, and I couldn't understand that he couldn't understand that I needed him. And so one particular harrowing day, we'd been at the hospital for quite a long time, and I said, you know, I came out of there, and I said, I don't know where he is, but I'm going to find him. And I got in my car, and I went and looked for him, and I did find him, and I said, you know, you better come home right now, because we're going to talk about this, and we're going to do something now, because I'm not going to live this way anymore. I went into the Elks Club, and he was downstairs, and he came with me. He came home, and we sat in the living room, and we talked about it, and, you know, we could always talk about it, because I could see that he didn't want to do the things that he was doing. I couldn't understand why he kept doing them. I certainly didn't know he was alcoholic, but I could see that he had a lot of remorse about it, and we talked about it. You know, I said, well, we need to do something. We need to go to a marriage counselor. And he said, no, I think I need to go to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I said, what for? And I didn't know what for. I mean, when two fellas came to get him and take him to a meeting, you know, I said to the one, I don't know why he's doing this, because, you know, we really just need to see a marriage counselor, and he needs to learn to come home. That's the only problem. So, you know, he knew what he had to do. I didn't know what I had to do. That was the problem. And so he went to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I went to an open meeting with him one Saturday night, And I heard a man speak about how the disease affected his family, and it was the first time I had ever heard another person say that that's what was happening in their home, and I could relate to it, and I cried during that whole meeting. And a bunch of people came back to our house afterwards for coffee, and a lady said to me, "Are you going to go to Al-Anon?" And I said, "Well, if I have time." And she said, "Well, I really hope you do, because you're going to find out that you're sicker than he is." And I was really angry about that. You know, right away my old mind started flashing these things about, I raised these kids alone, I kept this house together, I took these kids to church. He's the one. You know, why does she say that to me? So I decided I would go to Al-Anon to prove to her, you know, that I didn't need it. And I started going, and by the grace of God, I kept going. And during this time, Tim went to a lot of AA meetings, and he was gone a lot, and I accused him of not being any different than he had ever been. You know, he was just out going to AA meetings, and besides which, he wasn't coming home afterward, and he wasn't working the program right, and was he working the steps, and had he read his book today? And a lot of mornings, I put that book on the breakfast table and showed him the page. And finally, I just said to him, "You're going to drink again." And he did. And that was a blessing. That was really a blessing, because when he drank again, I had to really look at myself for the first time. And with the help of some beautiful people who are sitting here tonight, I kept going to meetings, and I learned what they meant when they said work the steps. And I just hung in there. And sometimes I think that's what it really amounts to. Just hanging in there, you know, just believing that your life can get better. Just trying on a daily basis to do what's in front of you. And I couldn't do those things when I came into this program. I didn't know what was in front of me. You know, I spent a lot of days looking out the window and wondering where he was and blaming him for my lot in life. And I didn't know how to look at myself. And that's what the steps have helped me do. That's what you people have helped me do. You've helped me to look at myself when it was too painful to do it alone. You know, I couldn't do that alone. I tried before the program. I tried to think the right things and I tried to do the right things. But I couldn't do it by myself. And the feelings stayed the same. You know, the resentment stayed there. The self-pity overwhelmed me. I couldn't get out of that rut. And slowly, very, very slowly, you know, my sponsor said to me, "In God's time." And I said, "In God's time? I don't have time. I got to feel better now." And I had such a negative attitude. Everything that could go wrong, I thought, would go wrong, you know. And everything that could go wrong, I thought, would go wrong, you know. And little by little, you know, through the steps, through really believing that I was powerless, not only over Tim and his alcoholism, but over my family, the people in my life that I'm closest to, my friends. And it's been a real struggle, because I think basically I am a person with a compulsive, controlling nature, and I don't like to give that up. You know, my security came in feeling that I could control other people's lives. And today my security comes in turning my life over to God. You know, there is no other security for me today. No human person can do that for me. And that's what I expected from another sick human being. Somebody, you know, to help me get my head together. I guess I don't like to pick out one step in particular, but I feel like the second step really helps me a lot with that. You know, I really believe today that God can restore me to sanity. I can't deny anymore that I was insane. I thought insane meant that maybe you ran up and down the street without your clothes, or somebody dragged you away and, you know, locked you up because you didn't know how to behave properly. Nobody out in the street knew what I was doing in my house. They all thought I was wonderful. You know, they saw this sweet, smiling, little, innocent thing, and isn't she something? And inside, I was a crazy person. I could be having the most horrible temper tantrum you could ever imagine, and the phone would ring, and I'd say, "Hello?" And, you know, I could just turn it off and on, like,
Nothing. And I never saw that about myself, because I spent most of my time looking at other people. I have come to know that my life is better today, not because of Tim's sobriety, or not because Holly goes to Alateen, but because I go to Al-Anon, and I try to live the Al-Anon program on a daily basis. You know, and I really believe that we have to do that as individuals. I don't think you can get better as a family by waiting for the other person to do it, or hoping that they will, or even praying that they will. But I think that the whole family can get better if you make it the most important thing in your life today to recover. You know, that had to become a priority in my life. I couldn't make it a hit-and-miss thing, and I tried to do that for a while. I just know, you know, that God works in my life each day. He gives me what I need for today, for right now, at this time, not for tomorrow. And I didn't know that for a long time either. You know, I wanted guarantees. I guess that's why it always is such a hassle for me when I stand up here and do this, because I want to know before I get up here what I'm going to say, and I can't. You know, I'd like to write something down and know that I could stand up here and read it off of a piece of paper. And I guess if I ever have any proof that God really is, you know, working in my life, it's that He allows me to stand up here and do this, because that's been the number one big fear in my life. You know, that probably overrules the fear of dying, and my close friends here tonight know that I'm also a hypochondriac, some neat little thing that I've learned about myself in my recovery that I didn't really know when I was sick, because I was, when I was sicker, because I was too busy looking at other people. But, you know, I could never stand up and talk in front of people, and I feel like it's really, you know, just part of that miracle. I am learning, you know, to look at the people around me as human beings. I can see that Tim is a human being. You know, he's not there for my happiness. He's there to help himself. And in the meantime, you know, that helps us. The same is true with my children. They can't live up to my expectations, and that was a big part of my sickness. I had all these expectations for all these people around me. And today, I don't have to do that. You know, I have enough to do concentrating on myself and my recovery. And one of the wonderful things about this program is that it, as you do that and you concentrate on yourself and your own recovery and you keep the focus on you, it also helps you get out of yourself. And that's just kind of amazing to me, you know, because the more you recover, the more you find out, you know, the more you can share with other people. And that's really the secret. You know, that's why we're all here, to share with each other. And I never knew how to do that before. I wanted to do that. I wanted to do nice things for other people. I wanted to give, but I didn't have anything to give because I was empty inside. When I came, you know, I was alone, and you reached out your hand, and I was empty, and you helped me fill that void. And I guess I won't ever understand it, you know, but I know today that I don't need to. I just need to keep doing it. And I'm really grateful to be here this evening. Thank you.
Now I'll introduce the husband and the father of this trio, Tim.
My name is Tim, and I'm an alcoholic. I usually tell people, they say you get nervous when you talk. I said I don't really get too nervous when I talk. I tell them the reason why is it kind of reminds me when I was drinking, I used to get up with a bruise on my leg and feel like I had cotton in my mouth, and my wife was crying, and my kids were mad. There was a policeman at the door, my car was wrecked, and my boss was on the phone, and I used to get real nervous. So, yeah, I found out another way I get nervous is when they're talking. That makes me nervous, too. No reason for me to be too nervous. I got two sponsors out in the crowd there and my boss, so I shouldn't have to worry about too much. there's a little touch of nostalgia coming back here, and I thought, just like Lenny did, I was, when we agreed to talk, I didn't know it was going to be in Bloomington, and we pulled up here. I recognized the place immediately. I used to deliver pizzas to this place. The porch over on that way over in there is where I proposed to my wife at about 20 years ago. That's kind of funny in a way, but it's different. That's where it all started at, I'll tell you that. It wasn't her fault, but we, I remember when I was here, I think I probably dreamed a lot about coming back here in 20 years and speaking at this university. I kind of thought I'd be the chancellor or a trustee. Somebody told me I was going to be an alcoholic in Alcoholics Anonymous. I told them they were crazy. 4 years ago, they told me I was going to speak at an Al-Anon convention. I know that they were crazy. I used to get that literature all over the house and rip it up. I used to get little mementos and little sayings, and I recall one time I got a little plaque with a little tiger on it growling because I got up a little nasty, and I broke it and took it out and put it in the trash before I got dressed. But tell you a little bit about myself. I was born in a place called Centralia, Illinois, southern part of Illinois. That's my hometown. I was born in a medium-class family, kind of upper income when my dad didn't drink, lower income when he did. He quit drinking in 1953. He took a walk in the rain, and I tried that. I got wet. But he did quit drinking for some length of time, and it never worked for me. I remember as a child, I did think that I'll never be like him, even though I loved him. He was never home. He was a compulsive gambler, and I knew he drank a lot. I didn't know quite what it was all about. He separated from my mother when I was in the seventh grade, and he moved up to Elkhart, Indiana. And then we joined him about 6 months later. He had lost the house that we owned by a gambling episode over in St. Louis, Missouri. We moved up to Elkhart, and I remember that particular point in my life because up until that time, I'd been a good student and I'd been a pretty good kid. We moved into an upper duplex apartment that was a very, very low-income area, and I wouldn't get out of the car, and I sat in the car and I cried because I didn't want to live there. My pride was shattered. I got there in Elkhart, and all the clothes that I had didn't fit. The styles were different in that particular town, and that bothered me. I made friends that had good clothes, and I'd go over to their house in the morning and borrow their clothes and wear them to school. Kind of the turning point in my life there was that I became a bad student. I no longer cared much about anything. It kind of reminded me a little bit of what my daughter was saying. I just didn't care. If I couldn't be the best, then I didn't want to be anything. I got involved in a jacket club and a lot of shenanigans in high school. I remember the first time I drank, I got drunk, and I ended up crawling across the field to my house about a half a block. I did a lot of crawling. I think Lenny mentioned that. I don't know if she told you when she answered the door that night. I was on my knees. Did that one other time, I recall, too. I just became unhappy as a kid in high school. I got kicked out of school a couple times, one time for smoking on the school block. I was the type of kid that was cocky. I didn't like the idea I was short. There wasn't a whole lot I could do about it. I thought I was tough, and I wasn't big enough to be. When I drank, I knew I was tough, and I'd get beat up a lot. I remember, you know, to describe what kind of kid I was in high school, I used to carry a cigarette in my ear, and then I'd walk out of on the school and get my one foot on the curb and one foot on the street, and then I would light it as I lift my foot up off the curb. The teachers didn't like that too well. About the senior year in high school, I kind of started to try to change a little bit. I got a little tired of being called a bum, and the teachers kind of cut me down, and I used to get kind of stubborn at one time in my life, and I'd say, well, you know, I'm going to show them. And so I did a little bit better. I got out of high school and I wanted to join the Marine Corps. I thought that was a glamorous way to go. And I went to join it and my mom and dad wouldn't sign for me and I was only 17 years old. They wanted me to go to college. My dad was a house painter at that time and really couldn't afford it, but he did the best he could. And so I said, okay, I'll go. And the teacher said, well, you'll never make it there. And all my friends said, you'll never make it there. So that kind of became an incentive for me to come down to Indiana. I came down here in 1958, and I thought, well, I'll show them. And I went to work, and I worked hard. I didn't excel, but I passed. And it was kind of an experience because I decided that as soon as I did that, I'd shown them, and that would be enough. And I decided to be working, and it just didn't seem like that hard of a deal. And I thought, well, I'll stick around here. I didn't like school. I didn't like college. I didn't like grade school, and I didn't like high school. So I still don't like school. But I just felt like, you know, I started to have some sort of goals. I didn't know what I wanted to be, but I knew I had something I wanted to be other than something that was nothing. I didn't drink a whole lot in college. I drank every time I could. I didn't have any money. And when I got money, I drank. And I didn't drink every day because I didn't have any money usually. I met Lenny, and she had a checkbook her dad gave her, and we went through that pretty good. And I think I drank more then. But when we started out, we got married. It was in my senior year. I remember a couple incidences. I had to take an incomplete in one course, in a Spanish course here in college. And I remember going into to see the teacher, and I told him my mother had died, and that I'd been drinking a lot, and that I had a lot of trouble. And he felt real sorry for me. And I remember leaving there, and I remember walking out the door laughing about that. My mother's still alive, thank God. I remember thinking that was funny, that I'd really put one over on this guy. And I remember that guy distinctly now as being just one of the nicest teachers I ever had. I had a couple other incidences like that. I got married, and like Lenny said, she says 3 months. I think it was 3 weeks. But I just didn't come home, and I continued that for the next 15 years. And it wasn't because of her, it was just because of me. I was always wanting to be something that I wasn't, something better than I was. I didn't like what I was, and if I even achieved good things, it wasn't enough. I didn't drink for the taste of booze, I drank because of the feeling it gave me. It's like a guy I heard describe, you become a legend in your own mind. Just a magical potion that just gave me that magical feeling, and I liked it. I remember leaving Bloomington, and my wife and I, and we headed for Chanute Air Force Base, Illinois. I'd went through ROTC while I was here, and I was a second lieutenant in the United States Air Force. And I was what you call an OSI agent. I wore plain clothes at Office of Special Investigation. We got over to the Chanute Air Force Base, and one thing I discovered right away is that you don't get drunk as an officer in the Air Force. You have a little more trouble than you do in civilian life or in a college. I figured that out fairly quick, and they put me on the road, and I traveled around the state of Illinois. So most of the drinking I did was while I was traveling, and then like on the weekends, I didn't drink that much. I almost got into some serious trouble in that particular job. I remember one particular night in Peoria, Illinois. I was talking to some hooker in a strip joint before they became popular. And I remember I was telling her I was an FBI agent, and I was showing her my credentials, which looked something like it. I've never quite figured out why you're going to impress a hooker as being an FBI agent. And it didn't impress her, I'll guarantee you. She got away real fast. And I got out of there, thank God, because that was really a serious offense in my particular job, in fact. I decided that I'm going to, you know, change my life a little bit. I failed to mention that, just like when we left Bloomington. It was kind of my first time in my life. I said, you know, things are going to be different. I decided I'd volunteer to go to Vietnam. I wanted to make a better career in the service. I volunteered to Vietnam. They sent me to Korea. That's kind of the way the service worked, usually. And I got over there by myself. I think that's where the real alcoholism really, really began. I was over there by myself, and I had three or four different commanders. I had four different commanders at the time I was there in 13 months. Three of them were kicked out of the service. I really feel that each one of them would have kicked me out of the service had they not been kicked out themselves. I got into a lot of trouble over there, and I had a horrible record. And the last guy that came in was a guy that didn't drink, and he was a religious guy. And he didn't like me right off the bat. And he had heard about me, and he knew about me. I had to figure a way out of not getting thrown out or getting into too much trouble. I had a tech sergeant that worked for me, and he had adopted a little Korean girl, 4 years old, that he was going to take back to the States. And he had to leave before her papers had cleared. I went to the major and I volunteered to take this little girl back. Oh, he thought that was a wonderful, wonderful thing for me to do. And I knew he would think that. And so I commenced to not get into too much trouble the next couple of months, and then I ended up taking her back. And that was an experience, an alcoholic and a little four-year-old girl. We got on the plane and we flew back commercial. We went to Japan. I'm trying to stay sober. I got drunk about Seattle. And I had it timed pretty good to get to Denver with her, and then we got stopped for 24 hours, had plane trouble, and we got bumped off of one plane. And I show up drunk at Denver with this little four-year Korean girl and turning him over to her new father. And I went home. When I got home, I remember that was another time in my life that we were going to say this is different now, you know, like we're going to start a new life, and I'm not going to be that way anymore. I'm going to be different. We went to Cleveland, Ohio, which was the next assignment. I got to Cleveland, but by this time we had one child. I'd never seen him other than when he was born, and then I'd been gone for a year. We had another child, which was Polly, and I remember that particular incident well because my wife was in a hospital in Cleveland, and she needed $25 to get her out of there. I'd gotten paid that day, and I went out and got drunk, and I lost all my money playing cards. Went home. I thought, well, that's all right. I went home and got a movie camera I'd bought. I told her a couple years ago about it, finally. She always asked me what happened to the movie camera. And I sold it for $40, went back to the bar and got drunk and spent that $40, and I called my dad and he wired me $200. First time I'd had to do that. I discovered shortly after that that they had finance companies. I didn't know that I had good credit. I didn't know much about credit. And I kind of wish I hadn't found out that. But so money for the next several years never was too much of a problem because I just, when I ran out, I went and got some more. Eventually that caught up with me. In Cleveland, I'd left her in a little upstairs apartment, and what I did was go downtown Cleveland and work, and then I went to the racetrack in the afternoon, and then I went out at night. And that didn't go over too well, and it was a sad life for her, and I could see that, and she was unhappy, and we had to do something, and so we decided I'd get out of the service, and I decided I'd get out of the service, and we did. We came back to Elkhart to live, and again, we're starting a new life. This is going to be a change. I started to get a couple different types of jobs. We lived over our head, as usual, and I went and got a part-time job in a bar, tending bar for a guy that I used to work for. And I worked two different jobs in order to do that. Of course, I came home about 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning. That didn't work out very well. Make a long story short, then I went to another job, and it was 25 miles away. Between 66 and 74, I had some good things happen to me in my job as far as some sort of achievements in sales. I had nothing good happen to me as far as being successful in life. I had a lot of horrible things happen to me. I had 6 car wrecks during that particular time. I had total 3 cars out at one particular time. I had never been in jail. I had been on probation for my driver's license. One time in 1975, on December 17th, after a lot of this type of turmoil and the debts were way beyond my expectations, I was 6 months behind in my house payment when I first came to Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't know what I owed at that time, but I do later. I owed everybody, every bank, every place, and I had a lot of bad checks, and I had done a lot of things wrong. I went through a period where I thought I was dying. I'd been in the emergency room at the hospital 6 times. I'd been taking Valium for 2 years. I'd been drinking. I finally didn't go to the emergency room anymore because they got to know me, and they just gave me a shot in the butt, and they'd send me home. I thought I had heart attacks. I felt pains in my chest. And they'd put me on an electrocardiogram, and I'd say, right now, there it is. They'd say, nothing's happening. I'd say, well, you're nuts. But one night in 75, I went down to a bar, just a normal night, got drunk, woke up the next morning. I was in a motel. It was snowing. I got up. I went outside. I couldn't find my car, and I started walking down the street. I used to dress well. You can always tell how well I'm doing is how well I dress. If I dress well, I'm not doing very good. If I dress not too well, I was doing better. I wore expensive clothes, and I went down the street. I was a person that always got dirty when he drank. I think it's because I always fell, or I was in the mud. You know, I just got dirty a lot, and I always looked like, you know, I'd been out camping in a suit. And I didn't change clothes usually anyway, so it didn't make a whole hell of a lot of difference. I usually wore the same thing next day. I just shaved and went on to work. But I was walking down the street, and I went by a place I used to work, a car lot there, and the guys came out, and they were laughing at me. And I didn't feel like laughing that particular morning. In fact, I felt like crying. And they got me in the car, and they drove around. We found the bar that my car was at, and I got in it, and I drove home. My wife says, "You okay?" I said, "Certainly. Nothing wrong." I always said that. I went to work at this time. I had owned a car lot of my own. And I showed up. I got there, and I didn't feel good. I always said that I had the worst hangovers of anybody in the world, and I know there's some argument going to be on that. I always thought I was dying when I had a hangover. And I just that particular day, I'd had it. I was tired of being sick and tired. That's the way I felt. And that night, I went bowling. And every time I bowled, I thought I was going to pass out. And then I sat back along the edge of the bench back here, and I looked down at my stomach. I weighed 181 pounds at that time. And I'd look at this big stomach sticking out, and it made me sick. Sometimes my ego got me this program the first time. I just felt sick, and I went over to the phone at the bowling alley, and I called Alcoholics Anonymous. A gentleman showed up at my office the next morning, and he came in with a big book. He told me about himself. I knew him. I drank with him on numerous occasions. I hadn't seen him for a year or so. Wondered what happened to the gentleman. And he told me his story, and I liked it. I liked exactly what I heard. He gave me that big book, and I read it. I read it all, and then the next day or so. I immediately turned the cover over, you know, so nobody would see the Alcoholics Anonymous. I'd jump every time somebody came in. It kept me reading that book. And I went to a meeting that night, and when I got there, there was a guy named Elmer. Was the first guy to talk, and he said, "My name is Elmer." He says, "I'm an alcoholic." And he says, "I got here because I got tired of being sick and tired." And I knew I was in the right place. I understood what that was. I didn't know much about alcoholism, even though I should. My brother was an alcoholic, and he'd been in AA for several years. I just knew that made sense to me. Tired of being sick and tired made a lot of sense. I went every night, and I went for 31 out of 32 days. I used to tell them that. They used to get sick of that. I'd say, "I've been here 18 days in a row now. It's my 18th meeting in a row." I didn't do anything else. They talked about steps. I didn't care about that. They talked about the fifth chapter. I thought that was corny. Cunning, baffling, powerful. Hang on to the old ways, results now. I thought that was corny. I'd get done with the meeting, and I'd go to the bar, and I'd drink Cokes, and I'd drink 7-Up, and I'd drink Pepsi. I'd drink soda and lime. I'd drink everything but booze. And I did the same things wrong that I'd always done. Then all of a sudden, I went 57 out of 59 days. And then all of a sudden, I slowed her down. I ran across some waitress in another joint, and I started going every night again. But I really went about 5 times a week to 4 times a week to 2 times a week to 1 night a week, and I'm telling my wife I'm going every night. And I was sober 7 months and 25 days, and I was in this bar, and this gal was drunk, and she said something to me about the fact that I couldn't drink. And I said, I didn't say nothing. I just picked up a drink and drank it. And I walked out, and I went to another bar, and I had about 3 beers, and I said, "I can't do this," and I went home. And I went downstairs that night, and I stayed downstairs because I didn't want my wife to know I'd been drinking. The next morning I got up, and being the alcoholic that I am, I had a brilliant idea. I decided that 7 months and 25 days of sobriety should not be spent on 3 beers and 1 drink, that I should get drunk. Then I'll get drunk, and then I'll go back to Alcoholics Anonymous. So I called this gal up, and I said, "I'll tell you what, I'd like to show you how alcoholics drink." She said, "Okay," and I picked her up, and I went up to Michigan, and I got up there, and I decided, well, I'll drink martinis, make it real quick, it won't last long, get back quicker that way. I never could drink martinis, I knew that, I had trouble drinking beer. I got drunk, blacked out as usual. I always blacked out. I never heard people say don't black out. I never stayed not blacked out very often. And I don't know what happened, but I woke up at her house in the morning, and it related to me some things about, and she was mad, And it related to me some things about this German Shepherd dog that I was going to kill with my bare hands, and this guy came out with a shotgun, and it didn't bother me. And I won't go into all the other details, but I went home. By this time, my wife knew I'd been drinking. Next night was Monday night, and I went to St. Thomas group I'd always been at. And I walked in, and I told them exactly what had happened. I felt good about being there, and I was accepted. They understood what had happened, and I felt good when I left there. And I went out and I got drunk, and I stayed that way for 1 year and 5 months. The most miserable time of my life was that 1 year and 5 months. I had been detached, by the way, at that particular time. It later became detachment with love. It was not detached. We were just plain detached at that particular time. I tried to go back to Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't want to drink anymore, and I couldn't quit drinking. I'd go to meetings, and then I'd go get drunk. And then I wouldn't go for a few months, and I'd stop in a meeting, and everybody would say hi, and then I'd go get drunk. I just couldn't get back. And I'd meet my kids in the morning at 8:10. I'd try to be home in the morning so I could take them to school. And I'd tell them, they'd say, "Where you been?" I'd say, "I went to cleaners." I did a lot of cleaning. And I'd drop them up at St. Thomas School, and they'd go into school, and then I'd go in the church, and I would kneel down, and I'd pray, and I'd cry. And I felt terrible. And then I'd go to work. And then about 10 o'clock, I'd start thinking. I always got in trouble when I started thinking. About 3 o'clock, I'd think, "Well, I'll just stop and have a beer. I'll just drink beer. I'll just stop and have a beer." And I tried that many, many times before. I tried just beer, just wine, just anything, just Wednesdays. That's when I had a wreck with 3 cars, is when I was drinking just on Wednesdays for 6 weeks. But anyway, I'd go in there and I'd cry and I'd go to work, and by the time I got out of work, I'd start thinking that I could, you know, I'd just get home by 7 o'clock, I'd be a hero. And all of a sudden it was 8, and I used to time my drinks. I'd drink scotch and water, and I'd say I'll have, you know, 1 drink every 20 minutes. And then I would count. And if I'm done too early, I'd look at my watch, and then I would have another one after the 20 minutes elapsed. And all of a sudden it was 10, and all of a sudden it was 11 o'clock, and all of a sudden it didn't make any difference, because we all know your wife's no better at 11 than she is at 3, rather than she is at 11. It didn't make any difference. And the next morning, it'd be 10 after 8, and here I was, pulling up in front and taking the kids to the school, and I'd be back in the church. And I did that for a long time. One particular night on December 17, 1977, which was 2 years to the exact day that I came to AA the first time. I didn't know that until later. I went out one night. I never intended on getting drunk very often when I drank. I always wanted to just get to the point where I felt okay, where I didn't feel irresponsible, and where I felt that I was doing the right thing rather than the wrong things. Of course, it didn't work. I got drunk, and I ended up in an argument somewhere in a bar. And I'd left, and somebody's come and said, "Turn around, come back." And I made a U-turn, and I hung the car up over a curb, and a cop came along, and he put me in jail. I'd been in a police station a lot of times. I'd never been in jail. My brother-in-law was a lawyer. I knew the judge, I knew the chief of police, and I knew them all well, and I knew the mayor. I had a lot of enablers in my life that certainly tried to help me, that I wish hadn't have in some ways now. I was in jail that particular night, and I was sitting there, and I wasn't blacked out that particular time. They'd got me too early. It was about 2. I looked across from me, and there was a guy that used to do some body work for me, and he was drunk, and he was throwing up in the stool, and then he would come up for air and talk to me, and he'd say that he got railroaded, and he's in here for false pretenses and so forth. And then the guy next to me on my right, he was hitting his head against the bars, and his head was bleeding, and his hands were bleeding from hitting the bars, and he was deciding he was going to break out of there. And I'm sitting here looking at this guy, and I'm looking at this guy, and I'm thinking, "What the hell am I doing here?" And I'm thinking, you know, I don't have to be here. I can go to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I can give this up. And I kind of made a decision in my mind that I was going to go to Alcoholics Anonymous that particular night. I got out of jail in the morning, and I First thing I did was went over to see my wife. She was working at that time, since I no longer gave her grocery money. She had to take a job. And I went into the shoe store where she was working, and she says, "You okay?" And I says, "I'm fine." And I says, "I'll tell you one thing I'm not going to do, and that's go back to Alcoholics Anonymous." That's just, I don't know, that's just a deep, deep resentment I carried for a long time when I drank. And I went home, and I pulled all the blinds down like I always did when I was hungover. I didn't like any lights coming in from the outside, and I took the phone off the hook. I called my boss, said I wouldn't be coming in. And I went and I laid down, and I started to cry, and I couldn't quit crying. And one thing I had done the first time in Alcoholics Anonymous, I had picked up a sponsor, and I called him. And he came right over. And I told him, I said, "I want to go somewhere, real fast." And I said, "I want to get there now." And he made a couple calls, and all of a sudden, this lady and this gentleman who I knew in the program were at my door. And they took me to Fort Wayne, Indiana, a place called Parkview Memorial Hospital, called a South Unit, which is a two-story nut ward. And they got me in the emergency room, and they signed me in. And I remember sitting there, and I remember the lady typing down chronic alcoholism. And I remember sitting there looking at that, thinking, you know, why? You know, why do I let it go this far? I was there about 2 days, and I walked into the classroom, and a little guy from Fort Wayne walked in. His name's Bud Ferks. I'll break his anonymity, because he don't care anyway. He's a good friend of mine today. But he walked in the classroom. He's the guy shorter than I am, if you can imagine that. And he said, "What's your name?" And I said, "Tim." He says, "You were in AA before, weren't you?" I said, "Yes, sir." He says, "You make me sick." He says, "Your kind make me sick at my stomach." I thought, oh boy, here's a real dandy. I start crying. Cried a lot. I still cry a lot. And he's the first guy of all the people I ever knew in AA that I heard. Because I heard him. And I listened to him, and I believed what he had to say. On Christmas Eve of 77, he came up to the room to see me, and I remember thinking, oh boy, here he is. Well, on Christmas Eve, you think you gotta leave a guy alone. And that's the saddest, saddest moment of my life ever. In any period of my life, was on Christmas Eve of 77, because nobody came to see me. They were detached. And justifiably so. I don't say that. I don't say that as a smart aleck. He walked in. He says, "You know what's wrong with you?" And I said, "What?" He says, "You've been 17 years old for 20 years. And he says, "You're going to have to grow up. And he said, "You're going to have to get responsible. And he said, "You're going to have to take the step before the first step." And I said, "What's that?" I said, "I never heard of it." And he said, "The step before the first step is that you can't make a decision not to drink, that you're going to have to ask God to help you make that decision." He says, "You kneel, you get down, and you kneel, and you ask God to help you make that decision." And when he left the room, I got on my knees, and I asked God to help me make that decision that I don't want to drink anymore. I got up, no thunderbolts, no lightning, no nothing. Something good, because I haven't drank since. He got up, he left, and I got up. And all of a sudden, that treatment center made more sense to me, and all of a sudden, AA made more sense to me. When I started to leave there, the doctor that I had asked me, he said, "All right, Tim," he said, "now what are you going to do?" I said, "I'm going to go back to Alcard, I'm going to go to AA meetings, I'm going to read the big book, and I'm not going to drink. One day at a time." He says, "You won't make it." I said, "Now, why do you just been telling me that for 2 weeks?" He said, "In your case," he says, "you're so selfish and you're so self-centered that you're going to have to do one other thing. When you get back, you're going to have to try to help somebody every day. He says, it may be small and it may be insignificant, but you're going to have to get out of yourself somehow." I remembered what he said. I got back to Elkhart. And all of a sudden, these things weren't corny anymore. Nothing was corny to me about the fifth chapter of Alcoholics Anonymous. Everything made sense. Same people were there. The same ones that talked that I used to didn't like to hear talk, I now like to hear talk. The ones that I hate to see their car parked out in front, and I wouldn't go to that meeting because I saw their car. I now saw their car. I now went to that meeting. If things became different, my life started to change. I didn't go every night. I probably went 4 or 5 times a week. I remember that particular year, and then it was about 9 months into the program. Started stopping in a couple bars and started having a 7-Up or a Coke. I started thinking, wait a minute, I've been through this before. I remember this guy in the treatment center told me, he says, you know, he says, an alcoholic in a bar is like a homosexual hanging around the YMCA trying to quit. That made sense to me, you know, that made sense to me. And So I went to this lady that had taken me to the treatment center, Betty O, and I said, Betty, I said, I got 1 foot in this program, 1 foot out again, it seems like, and I got to get in here. I said, let me chair this meeting on Saturday night. And she said, okay. And I said to myself, I'm going to start going to about 7-8 meetings in a row, and I went to about 21 in a row, and I chaired that meeting that month, every week for that month. And all of a sudden, I was in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I remember then what the guy told me about helping other people. And all of a sudden, I was doing 12-step work up at 2 Northwest. And I remember seeing in the big book that when you can't, nothing else works, you just keep working with other people and you may get better. Or at least you'll have a time where you may find yourself. All of a sudden, I had 1 year in this program. I remember that. We had a birthday party over at Osceola. And I remember what I really felt was how little I knew and how little I had grown. I would have swore that in 1 year I could lick this thing and that I'd have it and everything in my life would be okay. When I came into Alcoholics Anonymous the second time, I owed something about $20,000 in personal debt, so I was 9 months behind on my house payment. I was caught. It took 3 years to catch that up. I went through the second year of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I spent a lot of time doing a lot of things. And I saw a lot of things happen in that year working with other people. I remember the incident, a lot of incidences, but one of them particularly, I remember the guy in the alcoholic convulsion and his head was in my hands, and he's a wonderful guy. And I remember looking at him, and I remember thinking, my God, what a disease this is. I seen just good friends die, and I seen things that, and real sad things that helped me by seeing them. Things about alcoholism aren't very funny to me, to be real honest with you. I like to laugh, but they aren't funny. I know that, and you know that. 2 years in Alcoholics Anonymous, it was a Christmas time, and I remember calling my mom and dad down in Florida, and Polly and my wife and my other two sons were on the phone telling them they love them, and I wanted to get on the phone and say, I love you, and I couldn't do it. Drunk, I could tell my mom and dad I love them. Hungover, I could tell my mom and dad I love them. 2 years sobriety, I couldn't do it. But I made myself do it, and I got on there, and I cried, and they cried. And I think the significant part of that is that that's kind of what alcoholism did to me, is it just kind of takes somebody, and it rips you in little pieces, and it takes a long time to put those pieces back together. It's hard to love somebody when you don't love yourself, and it's hard to even show a lot of love when you don't know how. Anyway, the next year in Alcoholics Anonymous, things in my life got a lot better. And in the third year, I could call my mom and dad, and I went down and saw them in person, in fact, and I can look them right in the eye, and I can say, I love you. And that's not hard to do at all. But it took 3 years to do that. And I'm still working on a lot of defects of character. I'm certainly not over a lot of the things and a lot of my hang-ups. My life has gotten unbelievably better since I came into Alcoholics Anonymous. And it's got a long way to go. I know that. When I came here, I was looking for three things. I wanted to learn how not to drink. I wanted to be happy because I was depressed. I wanted to have some self-respect because I had lost mine. And this program, through God as I understand Him, has given me all those things and many, many more. I thank you very much.